MLB's giving out their Rookie of the Year award tonight, and we're going to tell you who's going to win. Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Monday, November 18th, your source of news, notes, and updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. You can follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. He's Troy Brock, Troy B Baseball on the Twitter machine. And Troy, I want to get to this proposed Jonathan India for Brady Singer trade. And if you'd be better served to just go get Alec Boehm, I want to get to the Rookie of the Year races. We're going to tell you who's going to win those. But first, qualifying offer decisions are due at 4 p.m. tomorrow. And we're already starting to get a little bit of reporting about who was expected to decline them. Almost every player declines them. Less than 10% of all qualifying offers have been accepted in history, right? Last year, nobody accepted their qualifying offer. I believe the year before it was maybe just Joc Pederson. But we already did get news that one player that is going to take his qualifying offer is Nick Martinez for the Cincinnati Reds. So he'll stick around for the 25 season on a one-year, $21.05 million deal. And it was really interesting to see Nick Martinez get the qualify. I think this was the most surprising one of all to me because he looked amazing in the bullpen. 53 to third innings, 186 ERA. But he also flexed into the rotation, had a 3.84 ERA in 16 starts. And that's after he was like, he had a 5.46 when starting through the end of April. Like from that point on, he pitched like a 2.42. Does it make sense to have given Nick Martinez a $21 million deal for 2025? Or was this just something where they maybe panicked a little bit and didn't want him to leave for absolutely nothing?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of the panic because while Nick Martinez, like you mentioned, did have a good season and really closed out the year down the stretch as a good starter and had a really good year as a reliever, he's probably not worth the qualifying offer total. And so it's they did what a lot of teams do and overvalue their own, and they gave him the qualifying offer hoping that he would not take it and they would get something back if he did leave. And now they're stuck on the hook for that $21 million.
Yeah. It just, to me, this was something where I understand, yes, he was valuable and he exists kind of in that weird space where he's too valuable to just let walk for nothing, but he's probably not worth like he wasn't going to get $21 million AAV on the open market, even on a short-term deal. And given his age, like he's already 34, this is more than likely the last contract he was going to sign. So now he pushes that back a year and he'll hit free agency at 35. This is really something that I don't know if this is true, but the impression that I kind of get here and the thought process where my mind goes is Nick Martinez accepted the qualifying offer to punish Cincinnati for destroying his free agency market. Because nobody, I think, is going to really be willing to give up the draft pick or two draft picks for Nick Martinez like you would for a Willy Adames, for a Blake, you know, not Blake Snell, he doesn't have one, Corbin Burns, Max Fried, things like that. And so he doesn't really have a choice now. He had to come back because he probably, I would argue, probably wasn't going to get signed at all until after the season started and that qualifying offer deadline went away. So I don't think he had a lot of options here. I just don't really love it all around from a team perspective, from a roster perspective. It's not like Cincinnati has tons of money to throw around. And this probably puts a wrench in their free agency, guaranteeing him $21 million.
Yeah, now that they have to pay Nick Martinez that $21 million, I mean, you can only consider them as out on Juan Soto. And but no, good on Nick Martinez for accepting it. I mean, in his position, that's like you said, that's the best thing he could do. And he's was probably not going to get a better deal. And when he does enter free agency next year, he's not going to get a better deal than that, especially at 35 years old. So
yeah,
good on him. And just the Cincinnati Reds making another questionable decision.
He is now the highest paid player on this roster. I pulled up the payroll for 25. Jaime Candelario makes $16 million next year on a deal that he signed with someone else, right? He signed this deal with the Cubs.
Yeah.
So he signed this deal with somebody else. He makes $16 million, and then he'll make $13 million in 26. Martinez makes $21 million. Nobody else on the roster makes in the double-digit millions. Not a single other person.
Wow. And
as of right now, the 2024 payroll finished at $100 million. The estimated 25 payroll, if all their arbitration guys get the projection from MLB trade rumors, is at 101. And so unless you're committing to increasing payroll, which I don't think the Reds are going to be in that position, you've already really closed the door on adding more pieces to this roster, which in a vacuum, I don't hate the concept of we think Nick Martinez is valuable, especially if he stays as a starter and pitches like the 2-4-2 he did down the stretch. I just think for this team, that wasn't the right move. If Philly was going to spend $21 million on a pitcher, if Atlanta was going to spend $21 million, I don't think you hate this decision as much. But their payroll now is already at what it was last year. And yeah, you have a little bit of stuff you can do. Like Santiago Espinal, you traded for him. He's worth $4 million in arbitration as a utility guy. Maybe they move on from him. Maybe they don't. I don't know. But it just felt like the wrong decision for this team to make. And I mean, it feels like now you almost have to trade Jonathan India, who's going to make $7 million this year, just to kind of balance this out. And we'll get to that a little later in the show.
Yeah, for sure. And it's Hunter Green deserves better, man. They really have to bank on their young roster taking another step forward in their development this year, because as you said, they're already at and surpassed what they spent in on their payroll in 2024 for 2025 projections. So they're either going to, as we're going to talk about later, have to trade to upgrade their team or try and upgrade their team, or their young players are going to have to take massive steps forward, like Ellie De La Cruz, who is good offensively, is either going to need to move to a different position or figure out how to play defense a little bit better and not make as many errors. And right, they're going to need a full healthy season from Christian Encarnacio Strand. And it's just, it's not a good place that they find themselves in now.
Yeah. I will point out that they're one of the teams with a new broadcast arrangement for 25 as well. They were with Diamond Sports Group back in October. Diamond Sports Group said that Cincinnati was one of the teams they were going to drop. The Reds have officially paired up with Major League Baseball to distribute their game, similar to how the Rockies do it, similar to how the Padres, the Diamondbacks. That package for those teams last year was $20 a month, $100 for a season. We don't have prices for 25, but we also don't know, and it's assumed that that's not going to bring in as much money as the linear television distribution deal did. So that makes it tough here, too, to figure out what to do. It feels like one of the things Cincinnati's going to have to do is going to have to get outsized performances from young players. And we've seen the Rookie of the Year races be really interesting. That award's given out tonight by MLB. I believe it's 6 p.m. Eastern. Don't quote me on that. Somebody will quote me on that. Yes, 6 p.m. Eastern on MLB Network. But we've already talked about this on the show before. The National League group, all three of those guys could beat anybody in the American League group. And this is the year to have one position player award and one pitcher award that covers both leagues. But let's talk about these three players for each league. Who should win? Looking at the American League, Colton Cowser, Luis Gill, Austin Wells. It feels like for me, Colton Cowser is probably the one that wins this. He 24 home runs last year, tied with Jackson Merrill of the Padres for most among rookies. Eight more than any other rookie in the American League. He was a Gold Glove finalist in left. He can play all three spots, but Gold Glove finalist in left, was second among all left fielders in outs above average at +8. third among rookies in the AL in doubles, three triples, third in RBIs with a really nice 69. 77 runs scored was first there. OPS was third. It feels like Colton Cowser is the front runner for this. Am I missing anything that would think yes or no, he wasn't going to be the rookie of the year here?
No, I don't think you're missing anything. And it's crazy what the Orioles have been able to do with all of their prospects. Like,
funny how all it takes is losing 100 plus games for like five seasons and then being picking first in the draft a bunch to have a great young core, huh?
Right. And they've hit on all of their picks. I mean, you look at the Tigers who picked first in 2020 and they've not
Spencer Torkelson. Yeah.
Yeah. He has not lived up to expectations as of yet, but I mean, Gunnar Henderson, Adley Rutschman, now Colton Cowser, if they can get Jackson Holliday to figure out things at the plate in 2025, they are one scary team to face. But it's I think I'm with you. I think Colton Cowser is going to win this one pretty handily, if I do say so myself.
And I think the reason is the other two guys kind of have some flaws. The more flawed one of the other two, Luis Gill of the Yankees, he looked, I mean, we were talking, and I think you mentioned this on a show last week. We were talking early in the year about he could start the All-Star game in the American League, right? Ended up slumping down the stretch, finished with a 3.50 ERA and a 15-7 record. 151 innings, 77 walks to 171 strikeouts. And I think the big story here is the fading down the stretch, right? Yeah. I mean, he came out incredibly hot. And we see this so many times with young pitchers who debut, is the workload just becomes a thing. And clarify, he had major league time at 21 and 22, but first time, you know, being there and losing rookie eligibility here. This was something where, you know, he had a 0.70 ERA across six starts in May, went 6-0. And then in June, 6.45 ERA. You know, August, 5.25 ERA. Like, it really, you know, he rebounded a bit in July, pitching to a 3.33 after you get the All-Star break and stuff in there. But, like, came out incredibly hot and then kind of faded a little bit. Because of that, it, like, if you had to guess, would you say second or third for Luis Gill?
I'd probably say second for Luis Gill. And it's another case of he's going to be a big addition, a big part of the Yankees rotation next season, with a full season of healthy Gerrit Cole and Luis Gill, with more workload under his belt and the ability to pitch deeper into the season. Yeah. That's going to be a pretty nice 1 and 2 in their rotation. But yeah, I would say Luis Gill is going to finish second tonight.
See, I think he's going to finish third. And I think it's just because it feels like there's an inherent bias against pitchers in Rookie of the Year, right? You look at some of the best rookie pitchers that we've seen in recent years. Spencer Strider was second, right? Yeah. And it was just one of those position players can impact the game on an everyday basis while those starting pitchers are out there every 5 days. And it's why, and I've been banging this drum even before the Spencer Strider, Michael Harris thing, that you need to have a Rookie of the Year for position players and a Rookie of the Year for pitchers, because it just feels like it's so rare a pitcher will win Rookie of the Year, even if they're phenomenal, simply because those position players can do it every single day and they have a larger mental share of the credit when it in the voters' minds. And this feels like a situation where I just think he's going to end up finishing third to Austin Wells because it's every 5 days. And then the lingering memories you have of him are struggling down the stretch and then his postseason. And it's, you know, his postseason, he didn't pitch at all in the ALDS. He gave up 4 runs in 4 innings in the World Series in a loss. And then he started in the ALCS. I think he gave up 2 runs in like 4 innings with 3 walks in the ALCS. And so it's like a postseason ERA of like 6.75. I just think because of that, Wells is going to finish second.
Now, I will push back a little bit on that. Okay. As in my opinion, and mm-hmm. the way that things...
Oh, wait. Voting had to be done for the postseason, didn't it?
Yes.
That's right. Yeah, okay, thank you. Perfect. Yeah, sorry about that. That's on me.
But I will push back as far as these awards, for the most part, yes, a lot of the winners are deserving and a lot of the finalists are deserving. But for the most part, these awards come down to which player has the most hype surrounding them. And as far as between Luis Gil and Austin Wells, you heard a lot more about Luis Gil throughout the season. And True. So that's why I think he's going to finish second ahead of Austin Wells. It's just because of the popularity contest aspect of it.
Yeah. Hey, if you're watching on YouTube, leave us a comment down below. Let us know who you think's going to win the Rookie of the Year, or who's going to be the runner-up in Rookie of the Year in the American League. The case for Austin Wells, I think, you know, this isn't trying to rebut you because I think you're probably right. Just kind of trying to move on and cover Austin Wells real quick is, he was a starting catcher as a rookie for the Yankees, which is kind of hard to do, right?
Right.
You know, he didn't lead the American League in it, rookies in any category, right? But he was fifth in on base, fifth in slugging, fifth in homers and extra base hits, sixth in RBIs. And then he was pretty decent in the clutch. He was fourth among AL rookies in game winning RBIs. He was sixth in go ahead RBIs. Like, he was more of a clutch performer than you usually see from a rookie. While I do think this whole thing was flawed anyway, I do think that Wyatt Langford probably deserved to be in the top three. I don't quite know who you put him over. Willy Abreu, both of them had more war than all three of these guys. It does feel like Austin Wells gets a little bit of that clutch factor, and I think the voters might give him something for that.
Yeah, I agree with you. He had a really good season, especially as a catcher, and like you said, a rookie catcher for the Yankees. I mean, that's
not easy.
That's not a thing. Yeah. you've got it's been a while, but you still have big shoes to fill as a catcher for the Yankees. But
what position in New York do you not have big shoes to fill? Like left field, maybe? I don't know.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
I think that clutch factor is what's got him into the finalists, but I do still think he finishes third.
Got it. Yeah. It's probably when you made the case for Gil, I think I kind of went over to your side and think that could happen as well. Before we get to the National League real quick, I want to give a quick thank you to our sponsor, Encase Cards. Custom card manufacturer, really cool what they do. They take your source photos of whatever it might be. For me, it's youth sports, right? My daughter plays soccer. My son plays t-ball. Their artist personalizes for your child. I let my kids pick backgrounds for this. They didn't like the artist then went, they put the background on behind the photo. They go in and add stats, position, all that kind of stuff. Then they print it on high-quality cardstock, slab it, and ship it to you as a keepsake. So check them out, encasecards.com. That's ncascards.com. Okay, looking at the National League real quick for the Rookie of the Year. This one, like I said earlier, I think all three of these players would win the American League Award. But it is a couple Jacksons, Jackson Churio, Jackson Merrill, and then Paul Skeens of the Pirates. Churio first. Signed that pre-debut extension, and there was a point where it looked a little iffy, right? June 1st, his OPS is like 575. He apparently, they had a clubhouse meeting. A couple veterans sat down with him to kind of talk to him and things like that. The very next day, through the end of the regular season, he hit 305 with an 887 OPS. 16 of his 21 home runs came from June 2nd on. 15 of his 22 stolen bases came from June 2nd on. First player to join the 2020 club as a 20-year-old. And the night that they clinched their postseason berth against your Phillies, actually, he tripled and scored the winning run. So is this a thing where in a normal season, Jackson Churio would probably be the guy? Or is it because Merrill was so good all season and Paul Skeens is Paul Skeens that Churio's best chance is to finish third?
Yeah, I think Churio's best chance is to finish third. He had a fantastic season, and finishing third is nothing to shake a stick at, especially when, like you said, that he would be the hands-down winner in the American League. But no, I think that because Jackson Merrill did what he did the entire season, as well as being one of the best defenders at his position in his first year playing that position, I definitely think that Churio is going to finish third out of these three.
Yeah. And I think the Jackson Merrill note pointing out their kind of a reminder that he was plus 12 outs above average, having never played center field until opening day. I mean, it's not like he played both shortstop and center field in the minors coming up and just had to pick one in the majors. He was a shortstop in the minors. He played a little bit, I think, of like second and third, had never played in the grass. And he ends up plus 12 outs above average in a normal National League, may have been a Gold Glove finalist. We've talked on the show before how many great defenders are in the National League in center field. So we didn't get in there. But he led so many Major League rookies, not just National League, so many rookies in so many statistics. Tied for first in home runs with 24. The best batting average, batted 292 with a 500 slug. Fangraphs WAR 5.3, 162 hits. So he averaged one hit a game. Extra base hits, RBIs. And then it wasn't just leading in the stats, but being how clutch he was. Like, I don't know if people realize he had 5 game-tying or go-ahead home runs in the 9th inning or later, which led the majors this season. Not for rookies, the entire majors, and is the most a rookie has had since 1961. And he wasn't always hitting these off of bums. He took Edwin Diaz deep. He took Mason Miller deep. He took Blake Treinen deep. Like, these were good relievers. And so this is something where, because it, like, it's him versus Paul Skenes for the award, am I wrong for thinking that Jackson Merrill legitimately could win this?
With what Paul Skenes has done, and again, the popularity contest, I don't think anybody is going to take this away from Paul Skenes. But Jackson, any other year, Jackson Merrill is the unanimous National League Rookie of the Year award winner. And I touched on what the Orioles have done with their trend of rookies and having their draft picks hit. It's crazy what the Padres have done with moving shortstops to the outfield.
Yeah. Or just shortstops in general. Like, at one point in time, I think they had a lineup with like 6 or 7 shortstops, former shortstops in there.
Yeah. Just Tatis Jr. and Wright, he won a platinum glove. Jackson Merrill is one of the best defenders in center field after never playing the position in his rookie year in the majors. It's crazy what they've been doing. And he had a fantastic season. And again, any other year, it's his National League Rookie of the Year award. But this year, I mean, you got to give it to Mr. Livy Dunn.
Paul Skenes. Yeah. No rookie pitcher in the live ball era, that's courtesy of MLB, has made as many starts as he did, 23, with a lower ERA than his 1.96. 170 strikeouts. That is a Pirates record for a rookie. And he did not have enough innings to qualify for a lot of the leaderboards. It's one inning pitch per team game, so 162. But among all pitchers with at least 130 innings, he had the best ERA. He had the best expected ERA, strikeouts per 9, WHIP, and like just so many different things here. He's a Cy Young finalist. And while I don't think he should win, simply because both Wheeler and Sale had a lot more innings and starts than he did, this is one where it's hard to argue that he doesn't deserve to win Rookie of the Year, simply because, one, how dominant he was when he did start, and then, two, the fact that when he started was not up to him because they didn't call him up until May, versus something where, like, he got hurt and wasn't available. He was available. They just didn't call him up.
Yeah, and this is a guy we were talking about on this podcast. I know for a fact Christian and I talked about it a couple of times. We were expecting Paul Skenes to kind of scuffle down the stretch because he was reaching a amount of workload over the year that he had not touched before. And as we already talked about with Luis Gil struggled down the stretch because of his workload, never pitching that much in a season. Paul Skenes did not struggle.
No.
Like, he had maybe, what, one bad outing in the entire season? Maybe two. I don't have it pulled up. But it's insane what he did and what he was able to do on the mound just every 5 days for the Pirates. And as somebody who follows a team in the National League, I'm not looking forward to facing him on a more consistent basis over the next few years, because he is just insane.
If we're going to classify a bad outing as more than three runs allowed, he had a grand total of one all year. against the Dodgers, he went 6 innings, 6 hits, 4 runs, 1 walk, 8 strikeouts, gave up 1 homer, and it raised his ERA from 199 to 225. Right. That was in mid-August. Other than that, he only had 3 outings again of his, you know, of his 23 where he allowed 3 runs, 3 earned runs. Right. It was the very first one against the Cubs was 3 runs on 6 hits and 4 innings. He turned around the next week and had a six inning shutout of them, a 6 inning no hitter of them. Right. He allowed 3 runs on 6 hits and 5 innings against the Dodgers on June 5th. The Dodgers tagged him twice. They won the World Series, obviously. And then the third one was that Dodgers game on August 10th. So it was his debut game and his 2 games against the World Series champions.
Right.
It feels like this almost feels a little bit inevitable. In the month of September, when we're all concerned about the workload, he pitched 24 innings with 2 runs allowed across 5 starts. Just absolutely nuts. Although I do want to point out on the workload thing that he pitched looking at 2023 between his minor league and his major league thing. I'm sorry. 2023 between his college and minor league thing. He pitched 129 in the third innings. So this year was, when you count the minors and the majors, was 151. So it's not like it was a massive jump. He had a big workload in college, workload we don't usually see from a college pitcher breaking 120 innings. Granted, they went all the way to the College World Series and won it, but he, I think, was a little more prepared than a lot of other prospects to take a workload, a somewhat normal workload, and make 20 plus starts as a rookie, simply because his body was already accustomed to that workload, even if he wasn't always pitching every fifth day. So there is that.
Yeah, and another thing to point out in favor of Paul Skenes, and a lot of people probably forget about this. I did until you mentioned it. He was in college last year.
Yeah.
Now he's facing major league hitters and putting up an ERA sub 2. So,
I mean, number one overall pick, it's like, even for a number one overall pick, that's absurd. Like, that's not normal, and that's honestly not what you should be expecting. So absolutely wild. Okay, final thing here before we go, and it's funny how I thought this was going to be a short show today when we were talking offline. There was a proposed trade or a discussed trade that came out over the weekend of Jonathan India going from the Reds to the Kansas City Royals in return for right-hander Brady Singer. This was C. Trent Rosenkranz and Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic. Both good reporters. There's no reason to think that there's not some legs to this. They did clarify a deal is not close. The Royals are looking at several different hitters as they look to consider trading from one of their rotation members to reinforce the hitting group. From the outside, is this a really weird trade? And here's why I'm trying to ask this. Jonathan India defensively is fine, but his arm strength not very good, right? But that's not my issue. Offensively, his game is, I don't chase a lot, I walk a ton, and I've got a good batting average, right? He only batted 248 last year. It was expected was like 266, a little bit of bad luck there. But he doesn't hit the ball that hard. His average exit velocity of 87 miles an hour is 17th percentile in baseball. His hard hit rate of 36.5% is 28th percentile in baseball. And his barrel rate at 7.7% is right at like 49th percentile, right at the middle for MLB. But Kauffman Stadium is absolutely a pitcher's park. Yep. And so, you know, his 15 home runs this year would have been 8 had he played all his games at Kauffman Stadium, according to StatCast.
Yeah.
So it feels like he's not the right fit for what the Royals need, because they need a guy, you know, like, yes, they need somebody who can get on base, Bobby Witt led baseball among non-leadoff hitters, and at-bats with the bases empty. They need somebody who can get on. He can get on. But outside of that, the rest of the profile doesn't make a ton of sense for Kauffman Stadium. And then when you look at Brady Singer, he's got average stuff at best. And you want to put him into a homer-prone park like Great American Small Park. It feels like this is a weird fit of both players on both teams. I guess it makes more sense for the Royals if you think about the fact that India can get on base. We don't care if he's hitting doubles and triples or whatever. We just need him on base so Bobby Witt can drive him in. But this is still a weird fit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like it's just two small market teams that are trying to do something just to say they did something. Because really, neither of them, as we've already talked about with the Reds, are going to do anything substantial in free agency. And their biggest way of upgrading is going to be through trade. So this feels just like a, we did something. Congratulations. Here you go, fans.
Yeah, welcome. It's odd. Like for the Reds, you have Hunter Green, Nick Lodolo, Andrew Abbott, Nick Martinez. You're paying him $21 million. You need him to be in the rotation versus being in the bullpen. And you've got Rhett Lauder ready to come up. He debuted last year. And so if you trade for Singer, you have to either keep Lauder in the minors, which is using bullets you arguably don't need to waste in the minors, yep, or move Martinez to the bullpen where you're paying him $21 million to be a reliever. It just, I understand the Reds being willing to trade India to get some sort of improvement to the roster. I don't know why you wouldn't be looking for an outfielder or an infielder. And if you're the Royals, if you're wanting to trade for a second or third baseman because you don't love the options of Michael Massey or Michael Garcia, why not go get Alec Boehm of the Phillies, who at least can hit the ball hard and can give you a – his speed's not as good as India's, but he still – he doesn't strike out a ton. He puts the ball in play. He doesn't walk as much, but – he would give you more options as far as you can play him at second or at third, and would give you the ability to actually hit for power, which I don't think India is going to do in that ballpark.
Yeah, not at all. And Boehm is a guy that the Phillies have said they are open to trading this offseason.
Which blows my mind.
Yeah, you're right. And that's a whole nother story for a whole nother podcast. But
We'll do it tomorrow. Like, why would you trade Alec Boehm? We'll do that tomorrow.
Yeah, his like you said, his profile just fits so much better for Kauffman Stadium than Jonathan India's, because he is, while he did have 15 home runs and he had 20 in 2023, he's really a gap-to-gap guy, and that would play perfectly in Kauffman Stadium. And that's really where the struggles for Alec Boehm came from down the stretch, is he was trying to go back to what he tried to do in 22 and 23 and be a home run guy, and he's not that guy. He's a gap-to-gap guy, and that would work perfectly for Kauffman Stadium. And like you said, he could play third or second, and he even improved defensively at third base this year over the rest of his career. He's always been seen as a bad fielder. He had 5 outs above average this year, which was 87th percentile in Major League Baseball. So yeah, that would be that trade for the Royals would make much more sense, but it would probably take a lot more than just Brady Singer to get Alec Boehm.
Yeah, it's hard to say, yeah, we need to go get him, and then think you can't use the same compensation. Like, Brady Singer's not nearly as valuable to the Phillies with their great rotation as it is to the Reds. But like Alec Boehm, 40% up the middle, right? Like, yeah, he pulls less than average. He goes oppo more than average. He hits up the middle more than average. 3 of his 5 seasons that he's been up in the majors, and some of those are small sample sizes, mind you, like 2020, he broke 40%. He broke 42% hitting up the middle, which is literally gap to gap. Almost half of his hits were left center gap to right center gap. Yep. And so it feels like that profile fits better. But like you said, the compensation is a little bit harder to figure out than just than something straight like India for Singer. Both guys have 2 years left on their deals. Singer's expected to make, I think, more than India. I think Singer's projected to get like $8.5 million in arbitration. India makes $5 million this year. He's already signed. So, but still, a little bit interesting there. It just seems kind of odd. I feel like the way for the Royals to improve position player wise, find an outfielder who can get on base a lot, simply because I feel like the weakness of this roster as much as you don't have a great leadoff hitter outside of Bobby Witt Jr. could potentially do it, but you want to get RBI chances for him. Feels like the best thing you could do is find an outfielder to replace the current group you have. I mean, you're using your outfielders right now. Hunter Renfroe hasn't been great. Batted 229 with an on-base under 300 last year. MJ Melendez batted 206 with a 273 on base. Kyle Isbell batted 229 with a 287 on base. And, you know, both Renfroe and Melendez, I feel like, had defensive issues as well. And so it's like, if you like, you know, Drew Waters is your other option. He batted, he on base with 316, not a lot of plate appearances last year, but he batted like 188. It's just, I feel like this would be much better to get an outfielder versus an infielder if you are the Royals.
Yeah, absolutely. That outfield that you just read off, that's not great. And if you want to be a perennial contender, then you know,
which you have to be when you're paying Bobby Witt, but he has an opt out.
Yeah, and so you've got to do something about that outfield. You can't be upgrading your infield when your outfield is that poor at production at the plate.
Yeah. This has been First Pitch for Monday, November 18th. If you're listening on audio, do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube, subscribe to the channel, hit the notification bell. Tell your friends they can go to firstpitchpodcast.com to get more of our content on a daily basis. And we'll see you tomorrow on First Pitch.